Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey.
So you're in upstate New York. Has the weather hit there yet?
Yes, I'm in the snowy Catskills, and we have quite a bit of snow. I'm not even sure how much because it's too dark to go outside and find out.
Well, thank you for spending so much time with us here tonight. And I know it's very late on the East Coast. But let's get into it. You've written predominantly about musicians and music in your career, and even some previous work on Janis Joplin. But what I would like to know is what really drove you to write this book on Janis? I mean, there's no question she's the most significant cultural figure in the last 50 years. But beyond the obvious, what was it for you that really made you want to write this book?
I was very curious about Janis's musical path and, you know, being a fan myself, going back to when I got a hold of Pearl when it came out in 1971 by joining the Columbia Records Club, where you got, you know, 12 albums for a penny or whatever. And I'd read other books over the years, but I had never really gotten a sense of Janis's journey as a musician. So much, of course, was made about her, you know, tragically short life and kind of her misadventures and all that kind of thing. And I wanted to know more about the real Janis and how she became the singer that she was. She created a kind of persona that I, like many people, bought through her, you know, interviews that she gave. She gave great interview back in the day, and journalists loved talking to her because she was just amazing with coming up with the great sound bites, etc. But, you know, she kind of made it even seem like it was this effortless kind of overnight thing. She just kind of appeared fully formed as this great singer. But I just had this feeling there was more to it than that. And that was kind of what I wanted to do with this book.
Well, there was an incredible amount of research, I can only imagine, that went into the book. And I would think that a lot of it obviously started in Port Arthur, Texas, in southeast Texas, Janis's hometown.
Yes, I had the very good fortune to meet Janis's siblings, Michael and Laura, and over the years at a couple of different conferences at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, and that was actually the beginning of this whole thing, going all the way back to the first one was back in the 90s, and then another one around 2009. So that kind of started it, was meeting them. And then, yes, once we had an agreement between us that I would be able to look at some of Janis's archives, her letters and scrapbooks and those kind of things, of course, I wanted to go straight to Port Arthur, Texas to see where Janis grew up. Her home that she mostly lived in as a girl growing up there still exists, and a few people are still there who knew her back in the day. And also just go to the places that she, you know, went. The public library was a big place for her growing up, and different, you know, her schools, and of course, a few places still stand where she used to hang out in that area. So, yeah, that was definitely one of the first places I went to do research.
So, tell us if you will. How would you describe her brother and sister? I mean, what kind of people are they? What were the stories and the remembrances that they had about their oldest sister?
Well, they are both very interesting, and of course, Janis was quite a bit older. She was basically an only child till she was 6 years old. Then along came Laura, and then Michael was born when Janis was 10. So, you know, of course, they had very different experience growing up than Janis did, being the oldest child. But there's definitely certain elements of Janis's personality that I think you could say were kind of family traits. Michael, for example, is very artistic. He's an artist. And Janis, before she, started pursuing her life as a musician was a very gifted visual artist and really thought of herself as an artist and wanted to be a great, you know, painter. You know, she loved Modigliani, etc. And then her sister, Laura, is quite a good writer, and she studied a lot of psychology. She actually wrote a book based on letters that Janice wrote home back when she was first living in San Francisco in 1966 and 67, and her own kind of memories of growing up with Janice as a big sister. So you can see elements of the family dynamic in their pursuits as well.
Okay, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, I want to get more into this because I have a theory on that whole geographic area that I want to tell you about. Our guest is Holly George Warren, who is the author of Janice, Her Life and Music, and you are listening to the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX, visiting with Holly George Warren, who is the author of the new book, Janice, Her Life and Music. And before the break, we were talking about Janice's hometown, her siblings. And Holly, I want to tell you, in full disclosure, my mother is from Beaumont, Texas.
Oh, wow. So you got to go there as a kid, I guess.
I did. And growing up, I did spend a fair amount of time there. And, you know, there are a lot of really great artists from that area. As a matter of fact, my mom went to grade school with George Jones.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
And as a young man, my uncle worked in the shipyards in Port Arthur during World War II. I had cousins that are a little bit older than we are, and they were probably Janice's age. So when we would go down there, everybody knew about Janice Joplin. And I remember the first time I went there was in the mid-60s, and we're driving through Port Arthur, and I kept thinking I was going to see Janice Joplin. I mean, I looked at every store window and door, and, you know, she was, of course, long gone by then, probably right. In San Francisco or something. But, you know, I wanted to ask you what your impressions were, because I know that you and I are the same age. I think we are anyway. When you first heard her, how did she come across to you? What was it like? I mean, I remember being in Port Arthur and walking the same streets, I guess, that Janis Joplin did at one time, and thinking, gosh, she's so big. I mean, she's like Jimi Hendrix or something. And mm-hmm. Was that your impression as well at that time?
Yeah. I mean, you know, again, you remember, if we're similar in age, that there weren't a whole lot of women on the radio. And the women that were pop stars, if you will, at the time, didn't have such a distinctive image. I mean, growing up, the first female singers that I really recall that had a big impression on me, and I was a huge fan of the radio. I loved, you know, living in a small town in North Carolina, I discovered I could tune in on my clock radio late at night, around this time, to some clear channel stations like WABC in New York and WLS in Chicago, and just hear this really wild diversity of different types of sounds of rock and roll. And, you know, this is around the mid-60s, even pre, you know, Janice on the radio probably. Definitely. It was probably like 65, something around in there when I first literally became addicted to the radio. And, you know, I loved the Supremes, for example. I loved their music, and I would just stare at, you know, record covers with the Supremes, and they had a more kind of grown-up, you know, cocktail dress, like gowns, matching outfits kind of look to them. But definitely when I saw Pearl, for example, I can just visibly remember, you know, holding that album and staring at the album cover with Janice and, you know, her crazy, very colorful outfits that she'd put together, and just her whole, you know, persona was so exciting and so different. And, you know, I saw her on the Dick Cavett show, too, around that time, around, you know, earlier than Pearl, you know, which came out after her sad, tragic death in October 1970. But earlier than that, she was on the Dick Cavett show, and I remember just being fascinated by her. The other person that really struck me as far as the whole kind of package was Cher, you know, when Sonny and Cher were having hits and stuff. So both of them just seemed so different from the way women were usually presented in popular culture.
You know, when you write about how Janis was into the blues early on, singing the blues, one of the things that happened to me on one of the trips my family took to Port Arthur is I tore a small Lightnin' Hopkins poster off of a telephone pole in Port Arthur.
Wow.
And it was promoting an appearance that Lightnin' Hopkins was going to have at Effie's Go-Go in Beaumont, Texas. Tickets were $2.50 in advance and $3 at the door. And you can buy your tickets at the Record Rack in Beaumont or Ted's Record Shop in Port Arthur or, of course, at the venue Effie's Go-Go. And it was in cooperation with KWIC Radio, and you could even meet in person KWIC's Mitch McCracken and Dale Spence. And Lightman was going to be performing on that April 14th with his Jefferson County Blues Band. And as a young teenager and guitar player and singer, I just thought this was the coolest thing. The next day in Beaumont, we actually saw Lightnin' Hopkins busking in front of the Montgomery Wards. And my dad encouraged me to go up and put some money in his coffee can tip jar.
Oh, my gosh. So, I wish I could have known this and interviewed you when I was researching the book. I mean, these are the kind of stories I would have definitely included in the book had I talked to you. And, indeed, I think Janis, you know, I mean, of course, you know, when she was a girl in the 50s, things were quite segregated, and particularly in Port Arthur. I did interview some of her friends who told me that when African-American artists were performing, for example, at the Pleasure Pier, I don't know if you remember that place in Port Arthur, there along, you know, the water, that when African-American stars were performing, it was, you know, black audiences only, but they would sit outside in the parking lot, and I guess they could kind of hear the music coming out the open doors, et cetera. And even, you know, the section of town where the predominantly African-American nightclubs and bars were in Port Arthur, you know, the white people were not really, you know, weren't going there, and vice versa. So, in fact, Janis apparently back in like 1969 when she was touring with her Cosmic Blues Band after she quit Big Brother and the Holding Company, she had an African-American horn player, Snooky Flowers, with her, who actually grew up in Louisiana nearby. And he actually spent the night at the Joplin home the first time that they welcomed an African-American into their home for the night. And he apparently took her to some of these bars and places that she didn't get to go to when she was a kid in Port Arthur.
Wow.
Yeah, I think, you know, Beaumont being a bit bigger and maybe a little bit more progressive, that when she was a teenager, another person who was a big blues fan, Terry Owens, I don't know if you've ever heard of him, because he was later on in the 70s, he was responsible for helping to reignite some of the African-American blues players' careers. He was a huge blues fan, and he was a high school friend of Janis's, and he remembered going to some bars and clubs in Beaumont with Janis where they could seek out black music later on.
Wow, that is so cool. But that whole area, you know, while Port Arthur or Beaumont, it's not a music hub like New Orleans or Nashville or New York or L.A., but would you agree there's something there with that golden triangle?
Definitely.
Port Arthur, Beaumont, Orange, Texas. It's not surprising to me that Janis was playing blues. Even that was this was long before I ever went there. But there's something about, I think, that Gulf Coast region that may have been fertile ground for a young Janis Joplin to develop her many gifts.
Definitely. I mean, she loved radio herself. I mean, they would, what they called, you know, make the triangle, just driving around at night from Port Arthur to Beaumont to Orange, listening to the radio. And one girlfriend of hers from high school remembered, you know, and they started driving at like 15, 16 back then. They would actually go to the various radio stations, and she remembered one DJ, Steve-O, the Night Ranger, who they would literally go up to his night shift and just kind of hang out. And Janis just had this total thirst for knowledge about the music and about, you know, records. And they would offer, oh, can we go out and get you a cup of coffee? And, you know, just have these excuses to kind of stop by the stations. And when she first went to college in Beaumont at Lamar, and there was a professor there, Dr. Abernathy, who I think was in the English department, who had some 78s of Lead Belly and Bessie Smith, and particularly Bessie Smith at that period was another new discovery. She had learned about Lead Belly and Odetta while still in high school through some friends, some guys that she hung out with in Port Arthur who were a grade ahead of her. And then she discovered Bessie Smith, and that was all she wrote. She literally became the student of the blues and would, you know, listen to these records over and over and over again, figure out the lyrics, and, you know, around by about 62, 63, she started trying to write songs herself, kind of in that Bessie Smith vein.
We are listening to the voice of Holly George Warren, who's the author of Janis, Her Life and Her Music. We're going to break for a moment, and then I want to come back and talk to you about Janis's parents. This is the voice of St. Louis KMOX. We're visiting with Holly George Warren, the person that wrote the new comprehensive biography, Janis, Her Life and Her Music, on Janis Joplin. And I'm telling you, if you're looking for a great gift this holiday season, this thing is amazing. It is a masterpiece, Holly, and it's really hard to put down, at least for me. So go out and pick it up. I love biographies, Holly, but sometimes in the first chapter where they trace the subject's ancestors, I get a little bit bored, and I'm always anxious to get to the juicy stuff. Your book, on the other hand, in the first chapter, you're really laying down the foundation, that chapter called Pioneer Stock, and you talk about Janis's parents, and they were quite different from the other people in Port Arthur, Texas, weren't they?
Yes, they were. You know, her father came out first to Port Arthur from Amarillo, Texas, to kind of escape that whole Dust Bowl, Great Depression era of the 1930s. And Port Arthur was a real boom town with the oil business and refineries in town. And he ended up getting a job. He had studied engineering at school, at college. He had not quite gotten his degree, but I think he was quite good at what he did and got a job there. And then Dorothy moved out and they got married there in Port Arthur. And they were an interesting couple. You know, they both came from, the pioneer stock I refer to, you know, generations of members of their family had, you know, traveled west. And Mr. Joplin in particular, his family included cowboys and ranchers. And the mom's family had come up in Nebraska, and then her parents had ended up in Amarillo. So they both were kind of trying to build lives as part of the whole, American dream middle class and kind of make good. But they were quite unique in that her father in Port Arthur, and having visited there, you probably remember, you know, there were a lot of churches around town, but her dad was an atheist, whereas her mother came up in the evangelical Christian church and actually was quite a good singer herself as a young girl, but horribly lost her voice after surgery when Janis was about 4 or 5 years old. But she had first introduced music to her daughter. So the dad loved classical music, again, not the typical listening fare to a lot of people in the oil industry at that time in Port Arthur. So she had this musical kind of background in the home, which I think made a big impact on her growing up.
Yeah, you mentioned in the book that Seth would come home from Texaco and put on Bach or Beethoven. And, you know, in the whenever that would have been, the early 1950s, most people in that part of the country were listening to Hank Williams and Lefty Frizzell.
Exactly.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, mind you, but I mean, were these people truly intellectuals, her parents?
I think, well, Janice used to refer to her father as a secret intellectual, because indeed he would also sit there, literally apparently his eyes would well up with tears sometimes, just with the beauty of that music. And I think, again, he somehow, maybe there was like a subconscious effect maybe on his young daughter, who just really worshipped her father, that, you know, music could have such a powerful effect on a person. And yeah, her parents were quite, you know, book people. They both were avid readers. And another great quote from Janice is that in her family, as soon as you were old enough to write your name, you could get a library card. So literally every Saturday, her father would take her to this large, quite opulent library in the town of Port Arthur, which still stands, the Gates Memorial Library, which I went to visit when I was there. And, you know, again, instilled in her this love of books, a love, you know, of the intellect and exploring ideas and having family discussions over the dinner table about ideas and to speak your mind. And, again, these were not particular values, especially for girls in that period of time, to get most places.
Well, Janice certainly spoke her mind, it seems like.
Yeah, I think they created a monster without realizing it. Of course, when she discovered at age 14 On the Road by Jack Kerouac, that totally changed her head around, and she started thinking about other possibilities outside of these kind of middle-class values that her parents were, you know, and the culture were really instilling in her. And in fact, there's this beautifully eloquent passage in that book where Kerouac, his protagonist, describes seeing Beaumont, driving through Beaumont at night. And I'm sure I can just imagine the effect that had on Janice reading that, you know?
You bet. Wow. Yeah, she was really a smart kid. I mean, you write where she actually, I think she skipped a couple of grades in school, which wasn't necessarily the best thing for her, as it turned out. But very smart kid. I mean, she was a tomboy, and she really was kind of one of the guys with the musicians that she played with throughout her career.
Definitely.
Tell us a little bit about her influences, her early influences.
Well, again,
musically,
she, as we were talking about before, she loved listening to radio, you know, and this was the golden age of early rock and roll. So she got to hear, you know, Fats Domino, Little Richard, and Chuck Berry. And in fact, you know, skip way ahead, when she first joined Big Brother and the Holding Company in San Francisco in 66, those guys had, you know, loved that music too. So they actually did covers of some of those rock and roll songs, and even some kind of swamp pop kind of stuff that she had heard as a teenager in Port Arthur. She loved Jerry Lee Lewis. She loved Elvis Presley. But again, she had this just thirst for knowledge about the music. When she saw Elvis do Hound Dog on the Ed Sullivan Show, she loved it, but she wanted to find out more and was able to get a hold of the original recording by Big Mama Thornton of Hound Dog, recorded in nearby Houston for Duke Records, and she loved that version even more. I got to interview, again, some childhood friend of hers who had this vivid memory of her, a brother and sister of her, coming over and clutching this, like, listen to this. This is the real Hound Dog. You know, I like this one better. So she, you know, was able to find this music there in Port Arthur. And again, I think she was, you know, she was a Port Arthur girl. She probably heard Jolie Blonde, which was written by Harry Choates from Port Arthur. She was a Hank Williams fan. You know, he was on the radio at that time. And in her earliest music, when she first started performing in 62 in Austin, Texas, with a little kind of folk bluegrass combo called the Waller Creek Boys, she was doing some kind of country stuff. You know, Kitty Wells, It Wasn't God Who Created, who made Honky Tonk Angels, you know, a big country and western hit for Kitty Wells, and Rose Maddox, and, you know, some kind of hillbilly boogie kind of stuff, too.
What inspired her to make that move to Austin? How did that come about?
well, again, you know, being this fearless girl who read on the road, et cetera, she definitely was into the whole idea of the Beats, and she wanted to be a beatnik. So at age 18, she first hitchhiked to San Francisco from Venice Beach, California, where she was living for a time after a brief stint at Lamar Tech in Beaumont. And she was living out there and still thinking of herself as an artist, but wanting to check out the scene there. Had just started singing a little bit, but not really for much of an audience. Ended up back in Texas again. Just happened to go to Austin, where some of her friends from high school were going to college at UT, and just realized that there was this cool scene there where it could be a bit more of a, you know, kind of beatnik life to be had, and started hanging out there a little bit, and then convinced her parents to let her enroll at University of Texas during the summer of 1962, the summer session. You know, she claimed she went to study art like another Port Arthur native, Robert Rauschenberg, the great artist who had gone to UT back in, I think, the 40s. And so that was kind of her really first time performing for an audience. They, as a member of the Waller Creek Boys, they started getting all this acclaim locally there among the college kids playing on campus at the Chuck Wagon, which is in the dining hall, and then eventually graduated to playing at this kind of little roadhouse beer joint called Threadgills, which still exists mm-hmm. to this day. And that's when she really started winning over, you know, more and more fans. And that's when she decided to quit making art and become a singer.
Yeah, and you go into that in your book. I mean, she was a visual artist growing up, and then, as you just pointed out, got into music. What about the San Francisco trip? Now, when she went out there, she was singing some blues and some original music, and she actually met people like Jerry Garcia.
Yeah, in 1963, just, you know, the week she turned 20 years old, she yet again left college and this time hitchhiked to San Francisco from Austin with a guy named Chet Helms, who would later play a large role in her career with Big Brother. But at that point, she was part of the kind of North Beach coffee house circuit. There are a few folk clubs opening up and, you know, open mic nights and things like that in the Bay Area. And that's where Jerry Garcia had started playing with a little bluegrass group around Palo Alto. And soon enough, Janice was out in that area. There was a club called The Tangent where they would perform, and she first, you know, met him then. Same thing with Jorma Kaukonen, who was a college student at the time and was a big fan of the Reverend Gary Davis, a great guitarist and blues singer. And Janice met him at one of those kind of folk sings, and he backed her up on a few gigs playing guitar. So, yeah, she was out there off and on for about 3 years, from 63 to 65, and her voice was so powerful, and her blues was, you know, really, you know, making waves among people in that scene. But, you know, she was really young. It was a very hard life, you know, hardly any income from these gigs, you know, sleeping on floors and folk clubs some nights. And there was also a big methamphetamine scene out there, which she fell into. And by, like, the summer of 65, she had developed an addiction to that and was down to, like, 88 pounds and, you know, really near death, practically, and had to take the bus back to Port Arthur, where she was for about a year, with her parents nursing her back to health. And she went back to school again, re-enrolled at Lamar Tech in Beaumont.
To hitchhike out to San Francisco, I mean, that is big stuff. And very courageous, I guess, but she was a big thinker. We're going to take another break.
Yeah, she was fearless.
Yeah, we're going to take a break, and I want to come back and talk about the Monterey Pop Festival. We're with Holly George Warren, the author of the new book, Janice, Her Life and Her Music, on The Voice of St. Louis, KMOX. We're visiting with Holly George Warren, writer of the new biography, Janice, Her Life and Her Music. We're going to talk about that Bobby McGee song in a minute, but Holly, first, let's fast forward a little bit to 1967, June of 67, Monterey Pop Festival. That was orchestrated by producer and record label executive Lou Adler and John Phillips, founder of the Mamas and the Papas. And they had this idea that they were going to enlist all these San Francisco bands and only pay their expenses without any performance fees, and all the profits were going to go to charity.
Right.
Was that really the way it went down?
I think over the years, a little bit of money might have found its way to some charitable organizations. But because of that, and also there was kind of a divide between the LA musicians and the whole very cool countercultural scene in San Francisco. They, you know, the San Francisco musicians were quite dubious about the intent of the producers of Monterey Pop. And because of that, some of them were not willing to be filmed while on stage at Monterey Pop for a TV deal the producers of Monterey had made with ABC, and they had enlisted the great documentary filmmaker D.A. Pennebaker, who had made Don't Look Back with Bob Dylan a little bit prior to that, and most of the artists knew about that, but still, they thought they were going to be ripped off, and so sure enough, Pennebaker was not allowed to film Big Brother and the Holding Company, who just got this very kind of not the greatest slot. They were playing early Saturday afternoon, kind of the underground band, you know, segment of the 3-day festival. But Janis and the band were so unbelievable, and people really were just kind of blown away, particularly by Ball and Chain, which was a song written by Big Mama Thornton that Janis and her bandmates had discovered when they saw Big Mama perform the year before in a club in San Francisco. So Pennebaker went to the producers and said, "We have got to get Big Brother, we've got to get this girl Janis in the movie." So they were offered yet another slot to play one of the only bands, I think, probably the only band to get two sets, to play the Sunday night, at dusk, a much better time slot, the same night that The Who and Jimi Hendrix would go on and astound people as well, if they would allow themselves to be filmed. So that's what happened, and that's why we get to see this amazing performance that was included in the Monterey Pop film, which later was actually theatrically released. ABC decided they did not want to put on TV some of the acts like Jimi Hendrix, et cetera.
Well, I mean, when people saw Janis at Monterey, I mean, they were just gobsmacked. I mean, she is like an evangelist on stage. Did that performance change the course of her career?
It totally did. It also affected the dynamic of the band. Big Brother and the Holding Company were very much like the Grateful Dead, as this kind of a communal band. Everyone kind of had an equal say into the songs. People took turns singing lead, etc. with Big Brother, even though, you know, Janis was this powerhouse singer, you know, the guys in the band sang some of the songs, you know, as well as she did. But after all the focus on Janis after Monterey Pop, there was just a lot of journalists from all over the country, from the United Kingdom there, and they were all writing about Janis Joplin. So the focus started being on her. They got a record deal with Columbia. They were signed by Clive Davis. And they also signed a management deal with Albert Grossman, probably the most famous music manager in the country at that time, worked with Bob Dylan, et cetera. So those guys were really focused on Janis, too. So it changed things around for the band, as well as just making Janis become this kind of spotlight of pop culture, journalism, et cetera.
Holly, we've got about a minute or so left, and we don't want to give everything away.
Where did the time go?
I know. It's so fun. Because we want people to go out and buy the book. I'm not kidding.
There's some crazy stories in that book, right?
Oh, it is such a great book. But I want to ask you one more thing. I love it when you say freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose, that is Janis. That's her essence.
Yeah, and it's as Kris Kristofferson put it himself when discussing those wonderful lyrics that he wrote, you know, freedom can be a double-edged sword. By Janis wanting to seek a free way of living, to live outside the way that she had been brought up to live in Port Arthur, Texas, you know, she took a lot of risks. She made some choices that took her down some dangerous paths. And So that's, you know, that's the frightening part of that freedom to do what she wanted to do with her life. Luckily for us, she left behind this amazing music, and she totally opened the doors for women artists who did not have the kind of freedoms that Janis demanded. I mean, not just lifestyle things, but in the studio. I mean, hardly any women were producing records at that point. Janis loved working in the studio and became quite skilled at it and was literally working her way toward becoming a producer while working on the album Pearl in 1970. So, you know, that lifestyle and that freedom, and also the incredible different types of music that she did really, really changed our culture forever.
Holly George Warren, thank you so much for staying up late with us tonight. Your book is fantastic. Janis, her life and her music. Go out and get it. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time: baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in baseball isn't boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.